Letters of Intent. This is Brock.
And this is John.
First question is, and it's a weird phrase, letters of intent. What does that mean?
Well, these are intended to be, and they usually are, non-binding understandings between the parties to a potential deal concerning that deal's terms. There may also be some binding provisions in there about expenses, exclusivity, or even sometimes confidentiality. All that's usually handled separately, and they're intended to surface any of the major issues in the deal and try and get them resolved before people start spending big amounts of money in due diligence and negotiating lawyers and all that type of thing. They're also the bane of my existence because these things have all sorts of potential problems associated with them, and my experience with them has been mixed, shall we say, I often prefer other alternatives to a letter of intent.
So it's sort of a promise, which is...
Yeah, but it's a promise that maybe I'll promise sometime, but I don't want to promise, but if I did promise, then my promise might look like this.
So deals in the last decade or so move pretty fast at the onset. So when are letters of intent typically created?
They're typically done very early in the deal process. And again, not every deal has them. I think a lot of folks kind of shy away from letters of intent in public company deals. They're not unusual at all in private company deals. They're still done. But people get a little bit jittery about disclosure issues sometimes, even though these things are non-binding. And they tend to be more in the context of private deals than public deals. Public deals sometimes have them, but just my experience is they're more of a private company thing at this point.
So I'm
done pretty early. It's pretty early in the process.
Yeah.
But after you've done enough preliminary due diligence and kicked the tires around to get comfortable that you understand the valuation.
It's really the first thing that the first piece of documentation that's part of a deal, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the traditional cycle, you'd have a confidentiality agreement. You'd take a look at information. Then, if you wanted to move further, the next step traditionally would be the signing of a letter of intent.
And how much negotiation typically goes into them?
Well, sometimes way too much, and that's one of the problems with them. You sometimes end up negotiating your purchase agreement twice. A big part of their purpose is to try and surface and get a business understanding on every major deal issue so that there's less potential for surprises after people have gone down the path and are negotiating a definitive agreement. Sometimes, they move smoothly, and you can knock them off in a couple of days. But sometimes we've had situations where people have spent literally weeks going back and forth on these things and eroding a lot of goodwill and really kind of getting bogged down, with trying to negotiate a letter of intent. And again, you're going to have those issues anyway in a deal. At some point, you wonder whether you're better off just going straight to a definitive agreement. So it really varies from situation to situation.
And how do they compare to confidentiality agreements? You mentioned those agreements.
Yeah, and they're, confidentiality agreements, I think, are much easier to negotiate. They're pretty standardized, and there are usually only a few aspects of them that that people want to spend time bickering about, standstills, non-solicitation provisions, how long the obligations might last, limitations on how you use the information, et cetera. Those are the kind of things that people spend time negotiating, and there are, I think, fairly typical negotiating positions that people have, and there's sort of a dance that you go through in many of these things. So confidentiality agreements, in my experience, are a lot easier to deal with than negotiations on letters of intent.
And what happens if there's a breach in the terms of a letter of intent?
Well, again, I mean, I think people go into them, the idea is, well, this is all non-binding. We're going to surface these issues, and we're going to move forward with the deal, and then we'll have a definitive agreement. But if somebody doesn't live up to the letter of intent, then potentially you get to fight over whether you have a binding agreement or not. And that's not always easy to resolve. Even if you have a letter of intent that says it's non-binding, the text of a letter of intent is important, but the courts will also, and they'll honor that, but, sometimes there's ambiguity. Sometimes they may look at the conduct of the parties, whether people have acted in know, to their detriment or have partially performed the obligations that were supposedly going to be in the definitive agreement. External evidence can come in sometimes. Statements about, you know, hey, it's great, we've got a deal on this, that when you sign a letter of intent, can come back to haunt you. So, and the other thing is people think, well, you know, this is just a letter of intent. It doesn't have all the parts of the deal laid out in it. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that a court's not going to conclude you're bound in some fashion. You know, they can fill the gaps in an agreement, you know, as they see fit. You know, insert their commercially reasonable terms, or they may say, and this is more typically what happens, is that, you know, you may not have an obligation to proceed with a transaction, but you may have an obligation to negotiate in good faith for a period of time, and you may have breached that obligation depending on what you did after you tried to walk away from that letter of intent. In either event, you can face some pretty significant damages claims. And the classic example is the whole Texaco Pennzoil situation from with Getty Oil back in the 1980s, where you know, they had a letter of intent. Texaco jumped the letter of intent. They got sued, ended up starting in Delaware, somehow ended up in Texas, and ended up in front of a Texas jury, and you ended up with a multi-billion-dollar judgment because that Texas jury, you know, was perfectly comfortable saying, well, you know, you had a handshake, that's good enough down here for a deal. So it's not just a Texas thing. Delaware has indicated that, you know, you can be liable for expectancy damages, I mean, potentially lost profits for, you know, issues surrounding whether you've complied with an obligation to negotiate in good faith. So extricating yourself if there's a dispute can sometimes be complicated.
Great stuff. Thanks.
You're welcome.